A recent court decision is casting new light on what to do about Red Hill. It's where the military has 20 massive underground steel tanks, one which leaked 27,000 gallons of fuel. And that was 4 years ago, and to this day, no one knows where it all went. The fear is that the fuel will make its way to our drinking water aquifer, which would then be costly to clean. A circuit court judge ruled that the state health department improperly gave the military an exemption from underground fuel storage rules. The Honolulu Board of Water Supply is pleased with the ruling, calling it an appropriate decision. The Sierra Club's executive director, Marty Townsend, hopes the ruling will now give state health officials more reason to press for an expedited schedule to upgrade the facility or move it.
They could draft interim rules that remove that improper exemption for military fuel tanks. They could just speed up the rule process that they're already considering, or there's also a statute that or a bill before the legislature that is still alive, and they could participate in drafting new statutory language.
What would that bill do?
The bill proposes very specific requirements on field-constructed underground storage tanks, which are the kinds that are found at Red Hill. It's an improvement on the way in which the state has been operating up to today, which was exempting the field-constructed tanks altogether. It remains to be seen what option the administration would like to go with. And then based on that, we will figure out the next best steps.
Now, I know there's been, pushback by the Honolulu Board of Water Supply. The chief engineer was really asking for an expedited action plan. And really has been sounding the alarm in the community, saying if this gets into our water system, it's going to be a very expensive fix.
Yeah. I mean, just to be very clear, we're already seeing petroleum products in the groundwater monitoring. So it's not an alarm per se. It is based on the actual evidence. We are seeing petroleum chemical products showing up in groundwater monitoring, and we need to immediately address that in order to protect future groundwater or drinking water resources. The Navy negotiated a deal for 20 years to update and upgrade the Red Hill fuel tanks. 20 years is way too long, especially given the fact that, these tanks have leaked many times since they were built, and we were seeing petroleum products showing up in the groundwater monitoring, as early as 2005. If the Department of Health had properly established regulations that comply with state statute and regulated those Red Hill fuel tanks, it's possible we could have avoided this spill altogether in 2014. And so this, the idea that we have gone this long since 1998 when that statute was adopted to now without properly regulating these tanks, and to propose that we would wait another 20 years to bring them into compliance is completely unacceptable. So, I'm hopeful this is the opportunity now for us to change course and really give the kind of urgency needed to protect our groundwater from these fuel tanks. And, at the end of the day, if it's not possible to upgrade these fuel tanks, then they need to be retired. They were not built with the intent of being used forever. That's clear just from their design. They are very hard to upgrade. And we need to come to terms with the reality that the U.S. Navy may need to find better ways to store their fuel.
And you just say not here. not in the place where they're at.
Without 100 feet above our groundwater resources, yes.
And you had pushed for, double lining those tanks, short of moving them.
Secondary containment is the standard for all underground storage tanks. Every mom and pop gas station, they have double wall tanks. And so we want to see that same kind of state-of-the-art technology used at Red Hill. We want there to be no releases of fuel into the environment. That is a reasonable expectation.
Right, because we still really don't know where that fuel went.
No, we don't. But we do see spikes in the groundwater monitoring that show that there is at least some, that it is reaching the groundwater in some way. We're lucky that it's not close to the well that the Board of Water Supply uses to pull our drinking water, but it really is a matter of time. We're talking about the future of our primary drinking water resource. We shouldn't risk it like this. I mean, we're on course to be the next Flint, and that's not okay.
And the chief engineer for the Board of Water Supply, Ernie Lau, I know has, like I said, been pressing for an expedited schedule just because the fix, you know, once that fuel gets in our water, it's going to be very expensive to take out. And it does supply a good deal of Honolulu.
Yeah, the Navy has proposed, in the event that groundwater resources do become heavily contaminated, that they would use what's called an activated carbon filter on the spigot, basically, when the water is pulled out of the ground. And that's really not a solution from the Sierra Club's perspective. It doesn't address the contamination of our environment in and of itself. I mean, that aquifer feeds all kinds of streams and springs. You know, there's a lot of water resources that draw from this aquifer, and if we contaminate it, all of those resources also get contaminated.
And what made you folks decide to take this tack and go after the state?
We really wanted to empower the Department of Health to take a stronger position in regards to the Navy. And we recognized that part of the reason why we were in this weird relationship between the EPA, the Department of Health, and the Navy was because the Red Hill fuel tanks did not have a permit for, like all other underground storage tanks. And so researching that, we found that there was this exemption, but that exemption wasn't authorized in statute. And so by fixing this hole, we create an opportunity for the Department of Health to take a stronger position with the Navy in terms of bringing them into compliance.
Right, now that you've got the court behind you.
Right.
Okay, all right, so we'll just have to wait and see what...
I do want to let people know that there is a public meeting. The Navy is hosting a public meeting on March 14th at Moanalua Middle School in the evening. It'll be a great opportunity to ask questions of the Navy in regards to the different upgrade options that they are proposing, how much those would cost, you know, the options for relocating the tanks altogether. That would be a great opportunity to do that, so I encourage people to attend if they can.
That was Marty Townsend of the Sierra Club. The military has said the Red Hill tanks fuel the entire Pacific Fleet and are vital for national security. That community meeting again is next week Wednesday at Moanalua Middle from 6 to 9 p.m. Learn more on our podcast page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember comic and comedy club founder Barry Crimmins. He died last week at the age of 64. He was sexually abused as a child and became an activist trying to stop pedophiles operating on the internet. We'll listen back to our 2015 interview with Crimmins and his friend, comic Bobcat Goldthwait, who directed a documentary about Crimmins. Join us.
This afternoon at 3. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a look at the ways contemporary society invades the lives of the poor. But first, your quiz.
Ka ho'olawe, o hawaii. In today's backyard quiz, we're thumbing through our vintage collection of TV guides to test your knowledge of the detective series Hawaiian Eye. This precursor to Hawaii Five-O and Magnum P.I. was also set in Honolulu and was inspired by William Orr's hit show 77 Sunset Strip. The series started Anthony Isley, Robert Conrad, and Connie Stevens, airing for four seasons from October 1959 to April 1963. Another name on the roster caught our eye because of his local ties. This Kamehameha School's graduate first started behind the scenes as a technical advisor before catching his big break in front of the camera playing Hawaiian Eye's chief security officer. His reoccurring character went through various name changes in the first season before writers finally settled on Moki. For today's quiz, can you name this actor? And here's a hint. After Hawaiian Eye, he went on to play Detective Frank Kamana on Hawaii Five-O from 1974 to 76. You think you know who we're describing? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Benny Rietveld from Honolulu, Hawaii, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Public assistance is designed to ease social inequality and bring dignity to the lives of the poor, but does it strip away their privacy rights, depriving them of that very dignity as it does so? Kiara Bridges is a Boston University law and anthropology professor. She studied the lives of poor women who seek public assistance. She will argue in a talk at UH this evening that the system deprives people without money of the ability to shield themselves from state oversight. She's the author of a new book called The Poverty of Privacy Rights. I asked her to compare the lives of two young women, one poor and one well-off, who are each about to have a child.
The first probably most important difference is where they will receive their health care. And the person who is a little bit more affluent will be able to rely on private insurance. And as a result thereof, she will most likely be able to choose her doctor, a doctor who she is comfortable with. Maybe even have a relationship with the doctor already.
Mm-hmm.
And that doctor, because of our ideas about self-sufficiency and economic self-sufficiency particularly, will have ideas about the woman in front of him or her. And so he or she will likely think that there's not too much pathology going on, at least not socially. This person is self-sufficient, so we don't have to assume that there's something, you know, wrong with her, you know, ethically, morally, behaviorally.
Mm-hmm.
And the care that she will receive will be reflective of that. And most of the care will be directed towards her physical health, the health of her fetus, making sure that she has a healthy pregnancy, physiologically speaking, et cetera. However, with a person who's not affluent, the poor person, she will most likely have to rely on public insurance, Medicaid in this country, in order to get health care for her pregnancy and to get prenatal care. She will most likely have to go to a public hospital or public clinic to receive that care. And as a condition of Medicaid receipt in most of the country, most of the states in the union, it requires an extensive interrogation of things that exceed the health of a woman's physical body.
Mm-hmm.
The information required of poor women exceeds information relating to her fetus's health, physical health. And so basically the context in which a woman lived her life is open up for surveillance, regulation, and potential punishment.
Would you be asked...
Whereas the affluent woman will not be asked questions about the health of her relationship or any sexual or domestic violence that she might have experienced in the past, any past addiction to controlled substances, all of that is going to be interrogated with respect to the poor woman It's going to be recorded. It's going to be the stuff of future interventions by child protective services or social workers, et cetera. So that's the primary difference between the rich and the poor in this country.
You might get questions like, how many sexual partners have you ever had a problem with alcohol or drug addiction? The questions might get pretty intrusive and personal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, poor women are expected to basically tell every intimate detail about their life, you know, ranging from sexual partners, ranging from contact that you might have had with, you know, police in terms of arrest, any homelessness that you might have experienced, but also just like very just intimate details in terms of like, how often do you eat sugary cereals? And how often do you exercise, and how much exercise do you get a day? And so, like, these sort of questions are things that I don't mind telling, you know, my husband or my sister, but when it's required from state actors who really don't have a fiduciary duty to the person who has to answer the questions, but rather has this duty to report to the state, it becomes much more insidious and much more dangerous. And it makes the person who has to answer those questions much more vulnerable to state intervention and regulation.
Are you able to insist that it be, do you get some assurances that it's going to be kept confidential? Are you able to stipulate that?
Well, you know, there are guards that would prevent the sharing of information to third parties. However, there are exceptions to those guards that have been put in place. And I like to think about this program, it's called Operation Talon, where the database of food stamp recipients is run against database of persons with outstanding warrants. And both those folks who are both on both databases will receive a pretextual letter telling them that there is an issue with their food stamps. It's a lie. There is no issue with their food stamps. And so when they come down to an office to sort of fix the problem, they're arrested because they have an outstanding warrant. So we have these exceptions to these privacy protections that allow for the sharing of information in the interest of, you know, crime prevention or crime solving. And what that does is make the poor vulnerable to having their information shared among various agencies. And again, this is not something that would happen to those with private insurance, those who are affluent, because the government doesn't have their information in the first instance. Their private doctor does.
Kara, what you just described sounds to me like sort of a government-sanctioned deception of clients, right?
So, it's not even an exaggeration to say that it's deception. It's a lie. There's a pretextual letter. There is no issue with the food stamps. The only reason why the poor individuals receive this letter is because they have an outstanding warrant, and they're using their receipt of benefits as a carrot to attract them in to this trap, essentially, where they're arrested and the criminal justice goals of the government can be vindicated.
Has that particular practice been subjected to a legal challenge?
You know, I'm actually not sure. I do know that it's a longstanding practice, and I imagine that if it was to be struck down, it would have been struck down already. I don't have the numbers right in front of me right now, but I believe it's in the tens of thousands of people have been arrested under this program since it was first implemented.
Because, I mean, I'm not an attorney, but you would think that that would have a great deal of trouble passing legal muster. But then,
well, that's the entire point of my second book. Is that the things that we think are illegal, the things that we think we have rights to, the things that we think that our Constitution absolutely would not sanction, when you're poor, all of those ideas about propriety and legality and constitutionality are thrown out of the window. The poor are subjected to legal, like perfectly legal invasions of their privacy that the wealthy would balk at, that they would be outraged by. However, for example, the poor, as a condition of receiving benefits, have to allow an inspector to just walk through their home, look through their bedroom drawers, look in their kitchen, look under their beds, you know, for any sort of sign that they're actually not eligible for the benefits. Now, the wealthy receive public benefits all the time. For example, we have mortgage interest deductions, and that we should understand that as a benefit because the government has decided to give us something in exchange for our having paid a mortgage interest over the course of a year. I mean, can we imagine what would happen if the government decided that it had the right or the privilege to enter our home just to make sure that we're living there, just to make sure that the house is to the government's liking. The rich would balk at the sort of invasions that the poor have to endure by virtue of their poverty. And it's perfectly legal. It's perfectly constitutional. These programs have been challenged in court, and some of these cases have gone all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has sanctioned them as perfectly consistent with the Constitution.
Kara, in the course of your research, you've undoubtedly talked to women who feel the effects, women in poverty who have to deal with these kinds of scrutiny. What kind of things do they tell you?
Well, on the more pessimistic side, or what made me pessimistic was the amount of resignation that a lot of poor people have. Just the idea that this is what it is, you know, when you're poor and you have to turn to the state for assistance, or if you're poor and you live in certain neighborhoods, or if you're poor and you have to rely on public transportation or whatever, like that's just the way it is. This is just the way life is. So I was struck and saddened by the amount of resignation that the people who I talked to during the course of my research sort of exhibited around these things. Like I said, if the middle class, the upper middle class experience, you know, there would be rioting in the streets of America. So on the one side there was resignation, but on the other side there was a sense of I like to call it resistance. I actually end my first book with stories of very creative ways by which poor people are trying to avoid the surveillance and regulation and punishment that they otherwise would be subjected to. And like resistance can manifest in anything from, you know, just refusing. For example, at public hospitals in New York City, if you receive Medicaid, you have to meet with a nutritionist who basically criticizes your diet without offering you really any good advice on how to improve your diet if you're poor. And so they would just avoid when the nutritionist calls their name, they would just avoid them. You know, and so like there were subtle acts of resistance I witnessed all the time. And then I also heard a lot of women articulate the sense that they're not actually first-class citizens. You know, like they enjoy a second-class citizenship. Theirs is a citizenship that allows them to be have their houses inspected, allow people to question their ability to parent, to subject them to child protective services investigations. They have a sense of like this is not the citizenship that their wealthier counterparts have, and so there's a disassociation with the country and the body politic, and their sense is that they're not actually real participants in this country. And that's also very disturbing.
Kara Bridges, a Boston University law and anthropology professor, will discuss her new book, The Poverty of Privacy Rights, in a public lecture today at 5:30 at the University of Hawaii at Manoa's Art Auditorium. To learn more, visit the Conversation's Facebook page.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, basketball superstar Kevin Love opens up about his panic attacks. Are men getting the kind of mental health support they need? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Civil Beat. We've been hearing quite a bit about the homeless encampment near the Waianae Boat Harbor lately. Jessica Terrell has the latest talk about clearing out the illegal campers from that area. Morning, Jessica.
Morning. Thanks for having me on.
So what have you heard? What's the latest development?
So the state has come forward and said that they want to clear the land where the homeless community is and transfer it to the Department of Education, and they're hoping to have people out by early June.
Now, there was some recent meeting where I think the state was saying they had no plans to move them out.
So the state has maintained for a while that living there is not a permanent solution, but they've been saying up until as recently as February 14th that no immediate sweep was planned, nothing had changed. And so that's, I think, what's causing some frustration in the Waianae community.
Right, because we heard one of the group leaders, Twinkle Borge, talk about that they were under the impression they were going to get cleared out, but no one was confirming that.
Yeah, so there has been mounting concern for months now, I would say, that a sweep was going to come. There had been some signs that community leaders had seen, including water being turned off. And, you know, the state had said it had nothing to do with that. They, you know, needed to get this construction work done. But there had been concerns, and they've been really trying to, the leaders of this homeless community have been really trying to get their story out there ahead of time.
Right, and I know the issue with the water, that involved the DLNR. I think they were doing some, construction at the restrooms at the Waianae Boat Harbor, and they were, I think, shutting off the water because of some work that had to be done in that area.
Yeah, I think you're right about that construction project, but for people living in that community, there was concern that it was a sign. And the water use and the water bill, I mean, it's something that the DNLR folks point to as a reason why this community, in their view, is unsustainable.
Right. And I know I've been out there covering fires, and that's very near the high school, right in back,
I think. It is very near the high school. And what DNLR wants to do is transfer the land to the high school for use as a marine education center, I believe. But there are also people who live in that homeless community who go to the high school or recently graduated. So it's a complicated issue.
Right. And DLNR's big concern for aquatic resources has been the shrimp.
Yes. Now, the people living there, they have built some rock walls around the pools where those shrimp are, and they've even gone so far as to work with the biologist and reach out on their own to get training for how to care for them. So they're saying they've taken this on as their kuleana, but DLNR does say this is still something they're concerned about.
Right, and I know there are folks in the community that are working on a plan to try and house those folks there in kind of those dome igloo-style structures, either there or somewhere else. There's been talk about that. And then also parallels drawn to Bumby Kanahele's encampment out in Waimanalo and what happened there decades ago.
Yeah, so a lot of people that I've spoken to in the community, both in the homeless camp and in Waianae, want to see these people living there get some land to continue the community building that they've already done. Getting that land and moving people in just a few months, though, is a really big challenge.
Yeah, makes you wonder if that's very realistic. All right, well, thank you, Jessica. We appreciate you checking in with us.
Thank you.
That was Jessica Terrell with today's reality check from our partners at Civil Beat. Earlier this week, Honolulu's Mayor Kirk Caldwell threw the spotlight on an effort to plant 100,000 trees by the year 2025. It's a tall order, but it's the focus of a one-day urban forestry conference this week. We talked to Tom Donnell, Professor Emeritus of Urban Planning at the University of Hawaii, about the effort to try and follow in Australia's footsteps and increase our urban tree canopy.
The theme is basically, how do we go about increasing our tree canopy, our urban tree canopy, given climate change?
And why is that so important?
Because our temperatures are going to go up in the tropics as climate change increases. Temperatures will be different in different parts of the world, but it's fairly clear that it will be a rising temperature in the tropics. And trees provide shade, lower temperatures, absorb particulate matters, absorb CO2, take water out of the atmosphere. They're multi-virtuous, and we need to have more of them in our community if we're going to have a walkable, pleasant, beautiful community.
And so tell us, who's coming to this conference this weekend?
Well, there are a variety of people who are coming. Planners, policymakers, arborists, landscape architects, citizens who are interested in increased tree canopy. So it's a wide variety of people, including students who are pursuing studies in this area.
And I understand that we're looking to see what Australia's doing there and see if what works there might work for our city, too.
Indeed. Our keynote speaker is Ian Shears, who's been directing the tree development program in Melbourne, which has been very successful. And they've increased not just trees, but greenery generally. And they've moved, as they put it, from a forest in the city to a city in the forest.
And do you really think that's workable here?
That's what we're going to find out. Yes, I think it is. Actually, trees grow faster here than on the mainland. So if we just organize and get our act together, we can move more rapidly than many other places.
Now, I know the Outdoor Circle, which supports this idea, always talks about the right tree in the right place.
And that's a very important line. Actually, the Outdoor Circle and Smart Trees Pacific, both of whom have been working in this area, are two of the organizers of Trees for Hawaii's, for Honolulu's future. So they've been very in this endeavor for the start. And what's important is to make sure we get across to our policymakers and to citizens generally how crucial this effort is. Our main streets are relatively bare of trees, so we have a ways to go. If you want a really good example of what trees can do, go to the Manoa campus. Even East-West Center Road and the Manoa campus has a median strip that is just has trees from the beginning to the end. And the campus is a certified arboretum. And that's why it's so important to involve the arborists and the people that know trees And yes, it's you know, it's true that some leaves will fall on the ground, and certain trees are much more sloppy than others.
Okay.
And we'll want to avoid those.
Well, what's your favorite tree?
My favorite, maybe because we have it in our backyard, is a lychee tree that now is probably as old as me, and it isn't bearing fruit anymore, but it's sure giving shade, and it's sure absorbing heat, and it keeps our home cool. And now I'm looking at it, and it's kind of blowing in the wind, and it's a piece of beauty that makes our home even nicer and softens the lines.
And I'm sure you have lots of memories associated with that lychee tree, and you've probably eaten lots of lychee.
Yeah. In my youth, I used to climb it and shake it so the kids could stretch a sheet below and catch the lychees.
All
but
right.
I don't do that anymore.
Okay. Well, the next time your tree bears fruit, save some for me, would you? That was Tom Donnell, one of the organizers of the conference Trees for Honolulu's Future, Health and Conservation. He's professor emeritus at UH Manoa's Urban and Regional Planning Department. With the plan for more trees, the mayor has acknowledged there's also a need to be able to maintain them. The city just settled a $1 million lawsuit filed by a woman injured by a tree which fell during high winds. Find links to tomorrow's conference on the Conversation Facebook page.
Earlier in the show, we asked you about a local actor who got his Hollywood break on the show Hawaiian Eye, a series inspired by William Orr's hit 77 Sunset Strip. He first started on the project as a technical advisor, sharing his knowledge of the islands with show producers. He then went on to appear in front of the camera, playing Mok, Hawaiian Eye's chief security guard. An alum of Kamehameha Schools, he moved to California, where he graduated from the Pasadena Playhouse College of Theater Arts in 1958. After the show ended in 1963, Mossman would continue to find work in other series, most notably his recurring role on Hawaii Five-O, playing Detective Frank Kamana. He had a regular presence on television. He also made guest appearances on One Waikiki, Heart to Heart, and played Kimo Halama in the rebooted Hawaii Five-O. Some of you may remember watching Doug Mossman in this season 2 episode, Ki'ilua. That's today's quiz. Nobody got that today, but if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's new Career Center, helping students to explore careers, understand education requirements, and get localized data on salary and jobs. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Create a test that predicts how people will act, even when they're not the ones who've taken the test.
So we're predicting police behavior by not measuring police at all themselves.
How a psychological test can pinpoint where police shootings of minorities are most likely to occur on the next Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7.
Hi, I'm John Purcell from Monsanto Vegetables. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HBR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple Store or Google Play.
The Latin strain in American popular music has been around for decades, and our musical culture would be lost without it. Its modern incarnation in the music of artists like Gloria Estefan, Ricky Martin, Santana, and Sergio Mendes takes many forms, but with one common thread, rhythms you cannot resist. Matt Kattengub, former principal pops conductor with the Honolulu Symphony, is back in town with the Hawaii Symphony to lead a Latin pop revolution tomorrow evening. He's with us in our studio. Hi, Matt.
Good morning. Aloha.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
What makes music Latin? You know, what are the defining traits?
Well, the influences from so many different countries.
I know.
Is awesome. My particular favorite is Brazilian, because of its not only the Latin influence, but then the Western, the American influence of jazz that influenced Brazilian music. So
I know.
It became such a combination that was so hard to resist. Just ask Stan Getz and, you know, all those people who had, you know, and Antonio Carlos Jobim. And then, you know, then you got the influence of Cuba, and then you go really deep into the African influence.
Yeah.
You know, it's a style. There are many styles of Latin music. And, you know, to this day, we are embracing, all of them are being embraced and still in popular music.
Well, it's so powerful in jazz, you know, when right after the Second World War, when Dizzy Gillespie added a conga player, Chano Pozzo.
Yeah, Manteca.
A two-bass hit, and all those great, you know. And the country really started to, Latin strains just became part of everything at that point.
It kind of became a part of the culture. You know, I remember some old records I used to have in my mom used to have in her record cabinet of, Jack Costanza teaches you how to play bongos, you know.
It was
a big deal.
That's right.
It was a big deal. And people would buy these records and so they can learn the basic rhythms on bongos because, you know, bongos are small.
Sure.
And everybody, you know, can learn how to play it. So yeah, it's been around for decades. That's what I love about the show we're going to be doing is that it's almost like popular Latin rhythms from starting in the 40s, really, all the way up to literally this year. Every style is kind of represented over all those decades.
You know, when I hear a really complex Latin rhythm, it might be complex on paper, but my body knows immediately where the rhythm is, right? You might be something, might be in a weird time signature, but you won't figure that out till later.
Right.
Then meanwhile, your head's bobbing up and down.
Exactly. And as a musician, you know, one of our things we say is, where's one?
Where's one?
Where's beat one?
Exactly.
And there's a lot of, especially in Brazil, that some of these, the samba schools that you have hundreds of people playing these rhythms, but where's one?
Yeah.
And yet this entire culture knows where one is. And that's amazing. When you finally are shown where one is, you are blown away. And so it's as a musician, it's such interesting music, not only rhythmically, but harmonically too.
Well, because I wonder what kind of concentration it would take in a large ensemble with, you know, four or five percussion instruments where your job is to go 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, no matter what.
Right.
Everybody else does.
Right. They zero in on where what it is you're playing, the clave or whatever it is, the glue pattern that's holding it all together. It's amazing. And these people are playing these rhythms, especially in Brazil and Cuba, et cetera, you know, and a lot of them don't know by looking at a piece of music. That's not how they're feeling it. They're feeling it because it's in their culture. It's in their soul. And it really blows me away how the abilities can come literally from feeling this music. You know?
Well, how do you meet the challenge of getting that out of a symphony orchestra?
You know, I've been doing it, as you probably know, for years, and I'm fortunate enough to be able to write all the arrangements I do with the orchestra, so I'm able to, I guess, you know, custom make and make sure it works with a, you know, 60, 70-piece orchestra. And so, it, and, you know, you got to give these musicians more credit, and I always have, especially over the years, especially here when it was Honolulu and, of course, the Hawaii Symphony.
Yeah.
It's you know, it takes a certain amount of training to be able to just read the note on the paper, but then, you know, execute the feel of it and everything. Yeah, there'll be a little bit of some rehearsing and to do, because this is a pretty complicated show, but ultimately I want everyone in the orchestra and the audience to just have fun, because this is some really, really fun music.
What guided your choice of material here?
I kind of alluded to it earlier. I do a lot of shows where I love being able to have the orchestra and the audience listen to styles that begin in the earliest part of contemporary music and bring it all the way to today. So I kind of based the song selections, you know, on that. I mean, I'm doing Prez Prado's Cherry Pink and Apple Blossom White. A lot of people won't know that by the title, but when you hear it, you will.
It's a
classic big band piece, right?
Yeah.
But then we'll go through the decades at how Latin music was interpreted by certain contemporary artists. I'm taking out a song called Mambo Italiano, which was a big hit in the 50s for Rosemary Clooney and Perry Como.
Uh-huh.
And I figured I'd pay a little tip of that to Rosemary since that was our Grammy-nominated album here with the Honolulu Symphony. But, you know, and then we keep going. You know, you mentioned a lot of the artists, you know, Sergio Mendes, Santana, you know, Tito Puente. And, you know, we're talking about in the 60s now and 70s. And then you go into these modern artists like, you know, Jennifer Lopez shall I just say, Justin Bieber? He had a hit, you know, a few months ago on
with a Latin group.
Despacito. So I mean, we're covering everything, and so for this show as well as most of my shows, I love being able to give something for every age.
Yeah,
you know, and let's face it, sometimes a lot of people kind of classify a symphony orchestra concert as, you know, for the, you know, maybe slightly older crowd. You know, you're not going to see 20-somethings or 30-something. But I want to make sure my shows are appealing to all those people. I want to, you know, I think it's important, you know, not just for these shows, but for the orchestra world. Let's face it. I mean, we need to make the orchestra a very relevant product, you know, from here on out.
And this is a pretty good avenue to do it, because once you hear music that's it's the lure of the familiar.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually, this is kind of a Latin version of a show I do called Dancing Through the Decades, where, you know, we start with Glenn Miller and we end up with Bruno Mars. I mean, and everything in between, everything. So I and it's great to see the eyes of the various age groups that happen to be there. You know, if the grandparents decided to take the teenagers and they look up and going, this orchestra is doing a Taylor Swift song? I mean, you know,
yeah.
How great is that? And they all suddenly it becomes somewhat at least relevant to them. I went to a symphony orchestra concert and they played Justin Timberlake. You know what? Wow, that's pretty neat. So a lot of it has to do with that kind of, you know, feeling. That's what I love to do.
Well, you're also linking music to dance, and I'm not sure how they got separated. You know, but
I can't.
You got to bring it back, right?
I agree. So much. I mean, that's what I was trying to do here over the years is to have when people show up to a concert, it won't be tonight because we'll be, of course, in the beautiful Blaisdell concert. I mean, tomorrow night, and we'll be at the Blaisdell concert hall. But, you know, I love seeing people get up and dance to an orchestra. How great is that, right?
Well, it didn't used to be that strange.
No, it was not. It was not.
Well, thanks very much for coming in, Matt.
A pleasure. Appreciate you having me.
Matt Cattingoob, former principal pops conductor with the Honolulu Symphony, will lead the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra in a Latin pop revolution. That's tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Blaisdell Concert Hall.
Well, that event is on my radar, but there are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state. Morning Edition host Derek Malala joins us for a look at some events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar.
Mm-hmm.
And today and tomorrow, apparently, we can catch a one-woman play on Kauai.
That's right. It's called Tomatoes on a Windowsill. written and performed by Rita Andriello. The play is about Rita growing up in an Italian-American home with a strict father, her zany relatives, pasta, and opera. So a lot of things happening, and she'll be also singing in the show as well. Tomatoes on a Windowsill is tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 in Center for Spiritual Living, Kauai, and that's in Kapaa.
I love that title, Tomatoes on a Windowsill.
I know. Very descriptive.
And we have a Swiss piano trio performing at UH Manoa on Friday.
That's right. Rafale is French for a gust of wind, I'm told. And Trio Rafale has been breezing through the chamber music scene in Europe. The program includes music by Haydn, Tchaikovsky, and Ives. And this is the final concert of this season for the Honolulu Chamber Music Series. And this is happening tomorrow night in the Orvis Auditorium at 7:30.
And a folk rock group from Alaska is entertaining in Hilo tomorrow. Tell us about that.
That's right. The Blackwater Railroad Company promises that you will be inspired by their catchy, danceable, and lyrical songwriting. And they perform original songs and other music that inspires them from the obscure to the reimagined. You can see them from 6 to 9 p.m. tomorrow at Kukuau Studio in Hilo Town.
All right. Thanks so much, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at the events in our community that are going on, probably under the radar. But you can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
And Mary, around here, men just don't make pies. Yes, my husband-to-be had committed the grievous error of showing up at the Hamilton family Thanksgiving bearing homemade apple pies.
Join us for true stories about women. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at 2 p.m.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we'll look at the challenges involved in social work and ask why jobs that employ social workers seem to incur such high turnover rates.
Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Record a message. The number to do that is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandergrift.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Come back tomorrow for more of The Conversation.